listening to episode 2 of the always interesting Talentopoly podcast, keeping you up to date on everything you need to know in the world of programming, design, and IT. Welcome. I'm Jared Brown, the founder of Talentopoly.com and a developer. You can find me on Twitter at Jared Brown, that's J-A-R-E-D, Brown, and on the web at jaredbrown.me.
And I'm Stephen Dixon, a freelance UI and web designer and front-end developer from the UK. As always, I'm tweeting about something over at Stephen M. Dixon, and you can also check me out and all my social links over at stephenmdixon.com.
And I'm Brandon Corbin, the creator of the Aidify podcast, where entrepreneurs and startups tell their stories. You can listen to my past shows at aidify.com, that's the number 8, ify.com, or follow me on Twitter at Brandon Corbin.
Yeah, by the way, that is an awesome podcast. I listened to 2 episodes today, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait. Were those the 2 podcasts that you were on?
Maybe.
Perfect.
Yeah, nice guess.
I'm going to get a listener for every time I do an interview. And I know they will listen to at least the one that they were on. So that's my plan. Now I just need to have about 400,000 interviews, and I think I'll be good.
Yeah, that should only take you a couple decades. So, awesome. Yeah, and I totally like how the end of your podcast, you ask people to tweet you that they got to the end of it. I think that is awesome.
Yeah, it does. It helps. It helps motivate me. It helps that I know which people are actually making it all the way to the end. So I've just been trying it, and I do get some good feedback from it.
Nice. Okay, well, as those who have listened to our inaugural episode know, we like to have a beverage or two during this podcast, lubricate the vocal cords a little bit. So I'm curious, Brandon, what are you drinking tonight?
Yes, well, I am definitely well lubricated already, and I didn't anticipate it, but today I'm drinking the Formula, which is a Cabernet Sauvignon Shiraz mix from Small Gully Wines, and I'd like to thank the guys at Tasteful Times, which is in Fishers, Indiana, for finding it, and they're at tasteful-times.com. It's a 15.5% wine. It's really strong, and I'm about a half a bottle in, so I apologize for anything that I say on this show beforehand.
Nice.
Yummy.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. And what are you drinking, Steve?
I'm doing the whole British thing tonight. I'm drinking a cup of Earl Grey tea.
Nice. Now, you're having a cup and not a spot of tea?
No.
Awesome.
Well, what most people might be surprised to find is that actually Stephen's from the lower part of Kentucky, and he's really just trying to be embracing of that British style.
Very nice.
No, I'm just kidding.
So I have poured myself the ever classy Red Bull and vodka that I am drinking tonight.
We're going to be getting naked later.
I hope not.
That's for the explicit version of this podcast.
Yeah.
With special video.
So I am super excited. I decided to plunk down the cash and order myself a mic and everything that needs to go with it to start sounding a lot better during this podcast. So I got the Rode Podcaster, which is what Brandon is using and sounds awesome. And I think it is coming next Monday, so, and it can't get here fast enough. I can't wait to play with it.
Where'd you order it from?
Amazon, but I got the free Super Saver shipping.
Are you not an Amazon Prime member yet?
You know, that was the sad thing that I discovered is because I have an 18-month-old son, and we buy a lot of diapers. And I got free Amazon Prime as part of this Mom and Dad's Club promotion they were running. And for some reason, because my wife was ordering the diapers on her account, and if you go a few months without ordering more baby stuff, they don't renew your Amazon Prime. So I lost it like just 2 weeks before I bought all this mic gear.
I will never go without Amazon Prime.
It is
from
pretty
now
nice.
On. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, the mere fact that I can sit on my iPad, and so I came home one day, I'm like, I need a cover for my grill. And I sat down, and on my iPad, within 2 minutes, I was done. Boom, 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 done. I'm like, oh my God, next day, boom, there it is. It was amazing. Love it.
Oh,
80 bucks, well worth.
Yeah, I probably, if we were smart, we probably would just have one account and make sure that we order all our stuff through the one account.
You can actually share it. So, Emily, my wife, I gave her access to it. Okay. And so you can basically go in and say, yeah, give this person, I think you can have like up to three people or something like that, that can basically share the Prime account.
Nice. Yeah, we'd need to do that. So
yeah.
If only I had known that last Friday.
Yeah, but if you did, you'd actually be sounding better than you do right now.
Seriously, I listened to how I sound on the 8 to 5 podcast, and that alone was like, I need to go buy a mic today. That's what compelled me to do it.
It really is a world of difference. I mean, the Rode, just the richness of the voice. And Steven, I believe you said it was like the voice of God.
Yes. For all of our listeners, Brandon is the voice of God.
Which is awesome. No. If I'm God, we're going to have a lot of fun.
Very cool. Yeah, I got the shock mount to go with it. I got the pop filter. And I didn't get the whole twisty boom arm piece. It actually was back ordered. So I just got a little $11 stand. And I figured that'd probably do just fine for now.
Yeah, yeah. Those are nice, too.
Yeah. So, Steven is over in, you are in London, right, Steven?
No, Manchester.
Manchester, sorry.
Yep.
And
but that's like 2 minutes away from London, isn't it?
No, it's like a 4 hour to 5 hour drive away.
I didn't think you could drive 5 hours in anywhere in the UK.
If you drive slow enough. Okay, so, but the pressing question that both Brandon and I were interested in hearing about is all of these riots that are happening over in London, and it seemed like the last couple of nights, it's just, this is all the news is reporting on. The scenes coming out of there are just absolutely crazy. Really, many places all over England. What experiences have you had with that? Have you seen any of the rioting?
The thing is it was all over the news, for obviously with regards to London, and the rioting not even being related to like the incident that occurred. And then there were reports coming in of it happening in Manchester, and I couldn't believe this. I'm thinking, this is absurd. How can this be a related incident? And obviously the news kept on reporting it. So what I did is I wanted to see this for myself. Me and a few friends got in my car, and we looked around my hometown, because there were reports there of potential riots, which I couldn't believe, because I thought, what the hell's happening to this country? So anyway, we get to my car, and then our excuse was we had another friend in the car who actually has student accommodation down there, so if anything, we'd be dropping him off there.
Oh, okay.
So as we started entering the main city centre, prior to getting there, you saw a lot of people with the hoods up, like bandanas across the faces and things like that. And then tons of side streets, there was just smoke coming out, and these guys, just had these youths had, like I just said, the hoods up and everything. They were just filming all this stuff. And the police had closed one street off in Manchester, which led all traffic through down this one other street, which is probably one of the biggest streets in Manchester, Portland Street. And just as we were driving there, the whole road was covered with like smoke, and you had tons of youths all over the place with like all the headgear on and stuff. And then they were actually looting this music store called Dawson's. A guy was running around with like £3,000 to £5,000guitars, pounds being the cost of the guitars.
Right.
Because a friend of mine plays guitar, the actual guy who did the theme tune for Talentopoly's podcast.
Yeah, give him a shout out. It's an awesome intro.
He recognized obviously the costing and that of the guitars, and this guy was running around with like a keyboard under his arm, and a guy was running across the road with an amp.
Oh man,
it was manic. And then this particular girl thought she was, what we refer to as being hard, like being strong, by trying to do some stupid dance towards near the cars and stuff, and people were hitting the back of the cars. It was manic. And the thing is there's no reason for it at all.
Right.
Nothing. And it's been organized via social networks and stuff. There's no reason for it to happen. And what distresses me the most is that both of my grandfathers fought in World War II for this country, and now it's being torn up by its own people. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah,
which is
why I can't wait to immigrate.
I found it interesting that, and I don't know the name of the, they called them a football gang, so I assume that's a soccer gang here in the U.S., that that they said that they're going to start going into London to actually kind of be able to stop the rioting and do what the police haven't been able to do, which, you know, in one sense, I'm like, that's pretty cool, you know, where people are finally willing to say, okay, enough is enough, right? You got your stress out, whatever it is, that's fine. You got it done. But now it's time that we're going to stop this madness. So hopefully, man, hopefully you guys get this stuff. Because honestly, the BBC News, that's all they're talking about now.
Well, the thing is there's actually no reason for it. There's none. It's shocking. There's no reason.
Well, wasn't it something about police brutality that happened that kicked it off?
The thing is, there was a protest happening in Tottenham, and a gang member had a gun out, a loaded gun, which is illegal in the UK. And he was told by the police a number of times to put the weapon down, or otherwise they would shoot him.
Yeah.
And he didn't put the weapon down, so he got shot. You know what I mean? So from that, then riots happened, and then... But this is the thing, what the hell are there all these other riots in the likes of Manchester, Liverpool... Leeds.
Yeah.
These are not related to that incident. Now it's just, and the thing is, what's annoying is we refer to them as chavs. These youths, these gang. This is what I mean. That they want to be American gangsters. That's what they are. And I don't get it. I just, you can see I'm absolutely speechless. I just don't understand the mentality of why they're wanting to do this. So now it's going to be ages before I can go into Manchester City Centre before because they started fires on a main street as well. Like I said, so it's manic.
Yeah, this is kind of what I don't get, is how they're basically running amok unhindered and able to cause this much damage. I mean, are there that many more youths than there are cops?
To be honest, it is down to the parenting in this country. Let me just find something quickly. It's basically because there's so many rules and regulations in this country. For example, teachers can't physically harm the students if they've been out of order. Parents would get in trouble by the law if they smack their children. The police aren't allowed to carry guns. Here we go. It says, Britain's gone soft on discipline, soft on immigration, soft on crime. For example, you can kill someone in this country and only do 1 or 2 years and you're out. Parents are told not to smack their children. Teachers were prevented from chastising kids in schools. The police can't stop a troublemaker. For example, if they grab somebody who's being abusive and things like that, the police could then face a fine of assault because they perhaps might have been sued because they hurt the person. Kids have certain rights and things like that. The whole country has just gone to pot, and it's because England's part of the European Union. So it's a huge, long political debate, but basically, yeah, the country's gone to pot.
Now, you said you can't wait to immigrate. What's the plan? What's the plan there?
Well, my girlfriend's Chinese, and she was born in Hong Kong. So obviously, when we're married, I'll be able to inherit that citizenship. And provided we've got a few things sorted in this country, we can then just hop over there. Really, so
excellent.
Honestly, this is a country you don't want to bring your children up in, because the frightening thing is these people who've committed these crimes, they are going to be adults one day.
Yeah,
right.
And they are going to be the future. Ministers of parliament and things like that, and it's absolutely I don't even want to think about it.
All right.
It's crazy.
Well, stay safe regardless of what happens.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yep. We'll do.
Don't go outside at night. And with that, let's jump into some technology articles.
Yes.
So our first story tonight is Apple releases tool to create external Lion recovery drives. This, I have not updated to Lion yet, but this is something that struck me as a bit strange that Apple, I'm all for them ditching CDs and going straight to download only, but I think they did it without the necessary safety net around that. And this tool seems like it should have come out during the release so that you could easily make these recovery drives. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, as a big Apple fan that I am, I upgraded straight away. And I knew how you could create a recovery disk, per se.
Right.
To do a fresh install and things like that. And, I found the process just seemingly simple, and I really haven't had the need to create any sort of recovery disk or things like that, because for me it was a seamless upgrade. And my iMac's actually, how old's my iMac now? I think it's a mid 2007, 2008 range. It's one of the first aluminium iMacs. Mm-hmm. And Lion runs super fast. So I've not really had a need to create anything, any external recovery drive. So
I find it funny. So last night I'm running Lion on our home computer, which is named Fiona. And Fiona, so anytime there's a problem, Fiona's dead or something like that. But anyway, so Fiona had been acting up, and it's a Mac Pro 2006 era, but the quad core Xeon. So, it's with 8 gig of RAM. So it's a moose. I was having problems with these hard drives, these 1 terabyte drives that I put into it. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to do a verify the disk. And I had some errors. So I'm like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to boop, beep. I'm going to have to, boot off the CD. So I put my Lion disk in. I restart the machine. I'm holding down option. And then up comes the drives that I can select. Well, one of them was a recovery drive. So apparently, right, they've got that little partition that, you can then boot to. And I didn't do anything special. So the drive was there. But now if that whole drive completely failed, obviously, then that recovery boot would not be viable, and I would have had to go through, blah, 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 Snow Leopard.
Yes.
But all in all, I would say I was like, holy shit, this works. This is great. And I had a good experience. I was able to kind of fix up the drive a bit, and, Fiona is now humming along nicely.
Nice. Well, and, I usually do the upgrades for Mac OS X, but I know a couple of people that swear by doing a fresh install and never doing the upgrades.
I've done it on 3 machines now, and I really haven't had any problems. And I put, I'm abusive on these machines. Right. Now, CS4, the Adobe Suite, is a little sketchy, but all in all, on my laptop, it worked great. On Fiona, it worked great. And on a 15-inch MacBook Pro from 2006 era, no problems.
Nice. And now, do you have things like Ruby installed and full Rails installation and stuff?
I don't have any Rails stuff, but I do have my LAMP stack. My MAMP MAMP stack, not MAMP, but I do have my web servers running, and I haven't had any problems running with that either. I don't know about Ruby though.
How do you install MySQL?
I went through the homebrew.
Okay, and it left that alone.
Yeah, no problems.
Nice. All right. Cool.
With regards to doing clean installs and things like that, I am so, every time there's a new OS update, a new major release, I always do a fresh install, always, regardless of how tiny it is. And honestly, just, with Lion, I thought, I'll see how it is when I upgrade. And I did. And obviously, I'm still going happy now. And it just seems like it's been a fresh install. So, yeah.
It's a great operating system, hands down. I mean, and I gauge it based on how my wife uses it, right? So she's somewhat technical, but not to the levels that we are. And she loves Lion. I mean, just loves it. Loves the gestures, loves everything about it, and is using every single damn feature that it has now.
So I think before episode 3, Jared should have Lion installed.
I agree.
No questions.
I'm getting convinced quickly here. I might download this nice assistant just to make sure that I have a recovery tool, but I need my safety net. So our next story is another Apple story, and this one I found particularly interesting. Apple to Lodsys, is that how you guys pronounce that?
That's how I would say it.
Okay, yeah. So Apple to Lodsys, you'll have to go through us to sue iOS devs. And basically what this story is about is Lodsys is a patent troll in the worst sense. They bought some patents from some venture company, and The weird thing is Apple actually licensed these patents from this venture company a couple of years ago. They paid to license them fairly, and Lotsis is not suing Apple. Lotsis is suing the developers that make iPhone apps and saying, well, they don't have the permission to do whatever touchscreen or whatever these patents cover, and are suing them directly. And Apple now has stepped in and said, we're going to back that up. We're going to say that, you know, we need to intervene in any of these court cases that you have gone and created in these lawsuits against the developers. And we're going to intervene and start, you know, taking you down in court, basically, to back, you know, to take on Lotsis so the developers don't have to go to court.
That is brilliant. And I applaud Apple for saying, look, you know, yeah, we're going to use our big swinging dick and you're going to have to go through us first. I mean, that's, you know, you don't really see that where corporations are willing to truly stand up for the end user. In this case, the developers of iOS stuff. I mean, obviously they're making a crap load of money from them, but nonetheless, I applaud Apple for the action of saying, you know what, you troll,
absolutely,
you got to go through the giant here first.
And this, I think I speak on all three. Sorry. Well, I was just going to say, I think I speak on behalf of all of us. Just Lotsis are assholes.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, they're definitely just that, fishing for some more money here.
It's pathetic.
So, basically, these developers, it was starting to have an effect on some of the developers. I saw some tweets and some blog posts saying that certain developers were going to stop developing for iOS until this got settled because they just did not want to have to deal with any lawsuits at all. So I think this is going to have a really beneficial effect on that because immediately it lets you know, hey, it's perfectly safe to develop for iOS. Let's not let anything derail this ecosystem.
Well, how many apps do they have right now?
300. Thousands, 400,000, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I mean a huge, huge amount. So it's kind of like, you know, if Apple, what's interesting too is that since Apple controls the whole ecosystem, I think they actually have a legal founding here, is saying, look, they're using our tools to create these applications, which we could have a whole sidetrack conversation of using, you know, third-party tools to build iPhone apps.
Right.
That because you're agreeing to their terms, you're agreeing from you basically have a contract with Apple that you're building these iOS in their, you know, with their platform. I think it's absolutely great that Apple's doing this, and hopefully, you know, they can just start laying the smackdown on all these damn patent trolls because it's ridiculous.
What I also found interesting is Lotsis is suing Android developers, just like they're suing iOS developers. And I have not heard whether Google is starting to file motions in those court cases to intervene and say that you have to sue us directly and not the developers. So
they sure as hell better. I mean, they really better, because if they don't, they're going to look like total fools. I mean, again, both Apple and Google have the money to be able to take these guys on, and if they don't, then that's just another kick to the nuts of Android developers.
Absolutely. I mean, they both have the armies of lawyers to take care of this. So our next story is CSS, text overflow property is interesting. This, not really so much a story, but just really great CSS tip here. Something that, property in CSS that I was only recently made aware of. The text overflow property is part of CSS 3, and what it allows you to do is when text is going to get clipped, you can choose what's going to happen. You can let it get clipped, so if it's going to flow outside of a div because it's too wide, you can let it get clipped as normal, or you can specify you want an ellipse to be shown, the three periods to be shown, mm-hmm. or if you want read more to be shown, something like that. I thought this was a pretty cool little property, something nice to do in CSS 3 versus, you know, having to do truncates in whatever language you're using or, you know, try to do anything sophisticated in your server side code. You can now do this in CSS. Unfortunately.
Yeah, this is a killer feature. I mean, and if you're developing for mobile apps, it's just a requirement, right? So in my world, we were developing a mobile interface for our e-commerce platform, and again, you're always going to run out of space, and that text overflow works like a charm. And boom, there's your three little dots, and it looks like, you know, a native app. And yeah, it's a great feature. If you're not using it, try it out. Unfortunately, it's not going to work in IE6 or 7 or 8 or
who cares?
It might work. Nine.
Who cares?
Unfortunately, it also does not work in Firefox, which I was really bummed about.
What?
Yeah.
Who cares? Sorry, guys. Sorry.
Yeah, that's going to start a flame war.
Yeah.
I'm just a big
WebKit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if you're on mobile, if you're on mobile, I guess it's not a concern. But if you're trying to use this on the desktop, it's not going to work in Firefox.
You know, it's funny now. Every time that I'm building anything, really my designs now are always, you know, I'm thinking about, okay, can I make this work more in mobile than like an Internet Explorer, you know, whatever X, and with this kind of properties and all that, it's really making developing web apps significantly more entertaining again. And it's just all those tiny little things that you can kind of do. But WebKit, yeah, I mean, to be able to build just for WebKit is a total dream.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. I'm sure at some point there's going to be a lot more, you know, Firefox or a lot more of these other, you know, as Windows Phone 7 or Windows Phone 8 starts to gain more traction, then you've got the IE engine you've got to develop for. Right now, we're really in this utopia of just WebKit.
Well, and I'm going to use this as a platform to say, Microsoft, why the hell would you not just start using WebKit? Why would you insist on building your own damn HTML rendering engine? It's the stupidest damn thing I have ever seen. You have a completely open platform that you can leverage right now that would be able to take advantage of everything that people are developing for, yet you assholes consistently refuse to use anything that's but standard. And just please, for the love of God, just say, IE guys, I'm sorry. Everybody, you're going to go now work on this other project that we're going to end up killing in 2 years anyway. We're going to be using WebKit. Please, for me, at least, just start using WebKit, and everybody would love Internet Explorer again. It's a very simple problem that you can fix immediately.
Yeah.
And that is by the voice of God.
Of course they will never do that. A couple of quick thoughts. They are actually making games with IE9. It looks
No. Yeah, that's great. They can support some CSS3 standards. Right. They're adding their own extra shit that's going to complicate the entire market again.
Yep.
It's ridiculous. It really is. And Firefox, while you're at it, go with WebKit too.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, you know, you've got Chrome that's WebKit. You've got Safari that's WebKit. And the simple fact is that you can, you know, most often than not, you'll have a different user experience with each different browser. Oh. You know, it doesn't mean that because you've gone WebKit, oh, it's going to be the same as everyone else.
Exactly.
Well, partly that's the point. You want it to be the same in terms of rendering and things like that, but you can also offer a different user experience with it. So,
very well said.
I agree with you all.
Yeah. Make your JavaScript engine faster, right? Make like OmniWeb, right, where they have their own unique features that make it worthwhile to those people. But why would you invest any development time into rendering HTML is beyond me and honestly completely irresponsible to the shareholders.
Excellent.
I agree.
And in episode 3, Brandon will tell us exactly how he feels about Internet Explorer.
And this is coming to keep in mind, right, that my full-time job is spent at a .NET shop. And so I've battled for the last 3 years and just secretly going and installing Chrome on everybody's computer. And they're like, my God, this is a great browser.
Nice. And don't forget, there is the Chrome frame for IE if they just cannot part ways with IE itself.
That's the most evil, brilliant thing in the world.
The other thing, just quickly, on IE is the fact that as much as I hate that browser, I still think there should be a version on the Mac so that we can test in it. Only because I do not want to go out and spend over £100 for a copy of Windows and then use Parallels or VMware and just to test one stupid browser just.
Are you old enough to remember that IE was the only browser that shipped with the original Mac OS X?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I started building websites when I was 14, so that's like 10 years ago now.
Okay, so yeah, they would screw it up, right? That it wouldn't be the same rendering engine.
Right.
I mean, they would build a completely new rendering engine, they would throw 400 developers at it, and it's going to be a completely set of different standards, and it's never going to work because they just simply cannot do it.
Or not willing to do it.
No. Not able to do it. It's a very different set here. It's not that, oh, well, we have these, you know, rules and what. No, from a technical standpoint, the internet or the developers there are just not able to do it. I am convinced of that.
I won't agree or disagree, but moving on now.
Yeah.
Our little Microsoft bash session is over for now. There will be no files in the cloud. This is an article by the ever awesome Fred Wilson over at avc.com. And I love reading this blog, by the way. He's always got insightful blog posts up on there. And this one is all about how basically just like iCloud, you know, that mentality of let's do away with the file browser. iOS devices don't have a file browser anyway anymore. And basically what you're going to do is you're going to use, you know, let's say you're using Spotify and you want to, you know, shoot that song over into radio.com or, you know, into one of the DJ apps. Now there's so many different, you know, FM DJ clones popping up. You don't have to actually select a file in a file browser. You just handle it by saying, hey, I want to send this over to this application. And it's aware of, hey, this is an audio file. What do you guys think about a file browserless future?
I have opinions, but Steven, if you have something, I'll wait patiently.
I mean, I completely agree with it. I love the fact that you can leave an application to control its own stuff, but then have that application, even though it's written by a completely different developer, have that application then use features from another, well, you know, like you just said with regards to Spotify, using aspects of another app. So, for example, I was reading Mashable today. I wanted to share something via Facebook. It then launched a Facebook app on my iPhone. I didn't have to copy anything across. And I know that's not exactly to do with files, but it's, you know, I'm using that as an example to see, you know, with regards to how applications work with each other. So with that in mind, you know, I'm in complete agreement that there'll be no files in the cloud. And I think having just applications concentrate on that, like how Apple are doing with iCloud and iWork and, you know, when all those things launch, I think it's just the best way to go.
Okay, so I'm going to completely disagree with you. And the reason I'm going to completely disagree is because let's take the whole API explosion that happened not, you know, a few years ago, where APIs were going to free us from any kind of really complex integration. And what we've seen is that every API that's built is completely different than anything else that's out there. And where I think the file kind of metaphor, the folder file concept, is based on this lowest common denominator of organizing information. And until we have a better metaphor that all of these APIs and what can consume and produce that's consistent across every single one of them, I think that this guy's on right, but I think he's 15 years ahead of his time, because I don't think we are even remotely close to being able to have, you know, where Spotify can talk to radio. That makes sense, right? But how does Google Docs talk to Spotify, right? And it's like we don't have this common denominator where we all agree that here's the structure that we're doing. REST-based kind of architectures tried to fix that, right? But we all know that it's a damn joke that no one can agree on the best ways of coming up with URL patterns or whatever. But right. The directory structure is something, while it is old as hell, right? I mean, it's older than all of us are. It's one thing that everybody can kind of agree upon when we're developing applications. So while I think he's probably right in the long run, I still think he's 15 years too far out.
Yeah, I think that it's really hard to kill something like the file browser off, because there are legitimate, it's a simple way to handle a complex problem, and people understand it pretty well. That said, I think that people like my mom have a lot of trouble with it, because how many times are you helping somebody who's not very good at computers, and they download something, and you're over the phone with them, and you say, okay, well now go run that install file that you just downloaded. And they go, huh? Where did it go? I don't even know. Like, they don't feel comfortable browsing a file system.
Okay. So let's now separate people out. One are producers and one are consumers. So I think from a consumer standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, right? For my mom, who's interacting and downloading shit and doing stuff on her iPad or whatever, which she doesn't have an iPad, so it doesn't really matter. but then you have the producers, right? And we are the producers. We are the people who are creating things. And for us, I don't see it going away anytime soon because it's we all agree upon it.
Yes. And that I would agree with. I think it breaks down to basic and advanced users, whether you see it or you don't.
I don't know. I mean, I can. It's gonna be two. It's gonna be two games. One. I think you're right in terms of the obviously the file browser is not going to go away immediately. But I mean, there's a lot of things that I can do now on my iPad that I, you know, that I don't need to necessarily go sit at a computer to do. For example, I can you know, using a browser now. On the iPad, I can edit, if I'm working on a WordPress theme, I can edit that straight away. I don't need to access any files locally or things, you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't need to copy and paste things across kind of thing like I would be doing if I was sat at my Mac using Coda or something like that. So, like you said, I think it all depends on which standpoint, which type of person you look at this from. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's up in the air. We'll see. I still think he's wrong.
What about Dropbox? Do either of you guys use Dropbox in your iOS devices?
All the time.
And that is a file system-based, browsable, you know, list of files, right?
Yep.
That seems infinitely more difficult to do a Dropbox-style app if you are going to get rid of the file browser.
Completely. I mean, because how do you sort? How do you do? I mean, hell, OS X when it first came out, right? The whole thing was we're going to get rid of the whole directory tree concept, and all you're ever going to have to do is search.
Right.
Right. You're just going to go up there. You're going to click, and we're going to have this whole indexed file system, and it's going to be friggin' amazing. You're going to love it. and the fact is it's just still not there yet because when you have more than about 20 items and you want to start categorizing them, you know, you can do tags, you can do different things, but for whatever reason, I just can't see developers coming up with a new metaphor that we can all agree upon. Now, again, I'm not talking just about, you know, your file browser that you have on your computer, but just, you know, hell, the web, right? How the web still kind of relates directly to here's the file, here's the folder on my server, and I'm going to go access it, right? So that's kind of where my whole motive is coming from, is more from that standpoint versus just, you know, here's what my Finder is.
Right.
Going on from what Jared was saying, and, you know, maybe the file browser doesn't have to disappear per se, but maybe how we interact with it and how we use it. You know, for example, when iCloud comes out and you will take photos and it'll be uploaded, they will be on a folder somewhere, right? But then you'll have a device or a number of devices that'll be able to access them and have access to those and get them downloaded straight away. And obviously that could work with other applications and other things that you're doing. So,
sure.
You know,
yeah,
that's that.
Yeah. All right. So our next story is, and this one actually became pretty popular on Townopoly last week, maybe because of the title alone, but it's kind of interesting. How I explained MapReduce to my wife. And it's, this really caught my attention because it's a cool story of this guy who explains MapReduce, you know, does his best at explaining in really simple terms in about 10 minutes to his wife. And the way he starts out doing this is he says, and they're in India, so he asks her, how do you prepare onion chutney? And she goes through saying that she's going to chop up some onions and some mint and some tomatoes and all the ingredients, and then she's going to mix it all together in the grinder. And he goes, okay, well, let's step back for a minute and take this one step at a time. You have map and reduce, which are two operations. So the map part is like you cutting up your onions and your tomatoes and taking your chili and your garlic and getting those all into pieces. That's your map operation applied to each one of those items individually. And then you need to take all of those and you need to grind them together. So first you take all your onions and you put them in the mixer grinder to get them nice and small. And then you add in the other ingredients slowly to that. And in the end, you've ground it all up and you've got yourself your onion chutney. It seems like an interesting way to get over some of the, you know, MapReduce is a pretty simple concept, but I think a lot of people try to bite it all off at once and it becomes complex, and it seemed nice how this guy broke it down. What did you think of that explanation, Brandon?
I liked it, and it's funny because about two weeks ago was the first time that I've ever done a MapReduce, what would you call it, method, and using MongoDB. And so I liked the description of it. I think it did make sense. It is kind of a very either high or low level, depending on which way you look at it, explanation of it, where I think when it comes down to the actual execution of it, it, like, understanding it conceptually is good, but then each language seems to handle it, completely different. So that's where my kind of confusion went. It's like, okay, well, Mongo handles it this way, and that's where I did it. But when I did it, I was like, okay, finally I got it. And it took me, you know, 3 or 4 days of just failing consistently to be able to make it work. And finally I got it. I'm like, okay, great. I'm taking this whole collection of stuff. I'm doing some operations on it. I'm getting a new result set back, and then I'm reducing it down to a subset of information. And that, so I did like the guy's explanation of it, and I don't know if it really helped me as far as being able to actually execute on it.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a good way to explain it to somebody who wouldn't ever really implement it.
Exactly. So I don't know what the fuck the benefit. Oh,
yeah.
Beep. Sorry, there's my 50 cents in the tip jar. We're going to buy a keg every time I say the F-bomb.
Except I'm never going to be able to drink any of it because I'm not in the same country, damn it.
We'll ship it to you using Amazon Prime. But I don't know what benefit it has to explain to the wife what MapReduce is. You know what I mean?
Right. It seems like something that would happen in India. You know, like, it seems like something. Please tell me about this. I want to know. Like, I don't think my wife is ever going to ask me what MapReduce and how it works, is and how it
works. I will never have that conversation with my wife.
So, moving on to our next story. 5 lessons from a year of tablet user experience research. These, for the most part, seem somewhat common sense, but I found it useful to read through this and let that really drive it home to me. And then it's some iPad app ideas really came to mind. So let me run through these real quick. We got trend number 1, trading home computer time for iPad time.
Yep.
Trend number 2, the tablet is a shared device and raises security concerns because multiple people in the family are literally fighting over using it. Trend number 3, tablet users need an experience-based incentive to access apps over the web. And then we've got, let's see here. Why is it only saying? Then we have the fact that iPad servers as a shared device presents unique challenges. I only see 3 lessons here.
That's basically what the guy had.
So let's just touch on those 3 lessons.
Okay. So I'll take this one. So for me personally, right, I would come home. I'm going to break out my computer once the kids finally go to bed and the wife goes to bed, and I'm going to do my work. And what's happened now with my iPad is that I do shift completely to the consumer side, where I'm just consuming information, whether that's with Flipboard or, you know, surfing or doing Twitter stuff on it. It's all a consumer device for me, and I use it a lot, watching videos, watching just all the stuff that I used to sit behind my desk, I'm now doing on my couch, and I absolutely love it for that. Where I think it always falls down is when it's time to produce. And when it comes to producing stuff, where I need to go and do something, if I need to type anything more than 140 characters, I think the tablet market is still very weak and the experience is subpar. That's my take.
I don't think it's ever going to try to replace the producer part.
I think it will. I do. I think in 5 or 10 years, we're going to find new things that are going to make it so I'm able to be significantly more productive in these devices. But right now, I don't see it happening for another 5 or 10 years.
Like Bluetooth keyboards or haptic response screens, that sort of stuff.
I don't know. It's like it's those things that we can't see right now until Apple figures out what they
right.
are.
Yeah, we don't even know what we want yet.
There's a few apps that allow you to use as a code editor, and I found myself going to sitting with clients and obviously changing a few things live on the site and showing them, you know, things that I've built in the HTML file, for example, yeah. and which I've just literally coded there. So, I mean, one app, for example, is Gusto,
mm-hmm.
and I've used that, and I don't know, I'm able to produce a lot in that term now.
Compared to your laptop, though, or your computer, right? Like where you just said that I can make small changes, but if you're going to sit there and you're going to write a full HTML document, my guess is that you're going to want to do it at your computer.
I would want to.
It depends. Yeah, I think it's because we're all used to that kind of scenario, and we kind of feel more comfortable doing that. But I mean, I'm in the process of doing that now, just using my iPad for a lot of basic development, you know, basic front-end development work. Obviously, you guys need... I mean, I use a local server to, you know, run PHP files and things like that, but nothing to the extent that you guys would use a local server for example. So, you know...
Local? I just added live on the site, man.
That's the hardcore way.
Sorry.
But the one thing I think that needs to happen with the iPad, for example, is where I think you could actually potentially do some good design on it is, for example, Photoshop or Fireworks. Having an actual inspector on there where you could change, you know, do a box from this XY value to this XY value and do things like that. But like you said, you know. That's not out yet.
Yeah, no, I could see where we could start doing creative elements, right? Like what's the name of the app? There's an app for drawing, and I've actually done some like pretty good illustrations on it. You know, so I could see the creative side being able to be done more easily on a tablet device. But yeah, when it comes to just banging on the damn keyboard, it's just still not there. Now maybe it gets to a point where we have like tactile response on the screen, right? Where we kind of have ideas of where our fingers are and things like that, where we'll make it easier. It's easier to hold or whatever. But definitely, I think the creative aspect where we're creating illustrations, we're creating designs. You know, I could absolutely see a Fireworks port to an iOS device be able to actually happen. But yeah, as far as like when it comes to banging on that keyboard, it's just still subpar in my opinion.
Yep. And two of the things that came to mind for me when I was reading this was one, that the prevalent use of iPads in meeting spaces. And I don't use my iPad in meetings right now. I kind of leave it at home. I don't bring it with me to a lot of on-site stuff for clients, but I want to start doing that more. I don't know what type of apps are out there, but it seems like there's possibility to do with some really cool meeting style, like notes and agenda type apps. And, you know, maybe
Evernote is amazing for meetings. I love Evernote.
I've heard many good things. I've not been bitten by the Evernote addiction yet, but hopefully soon.
Yeah, neither have I.
I use it for every meeting. I always bring my iPad to meetings, so at least it looks like I'm interactive, right? Well, maybe I'm playing Angry Birds or something, but Evernote is kind of my go. Like, if I'm in a meeting, Evernote is the application that's up that I can go and I can search, you know, find the past notes that I've taken that are like three words, like, this is a stupid meeting. But nonetheless, I can go in there and I can kind of produce stuff and I can type fairly fast on it. But yeah, Evernote is like the perfect meeting application.
Nice. The other thing I was thinking, I saw somebody who had a pen recently, and I kind of feel at times like I want to use a touch screen compatible pen with my iPad, and especially to do wireframing. So I'm a huge fan. I don't use Balsamiq or some of those other wireframing tools. I still am old school, and I grab a piece of paper and a pencil, and I just wireframe that way. And maybe doing that on my iPad would be a little bit better way of doing it.
I've got one. My daughter has an old generation iPad, and I've got the new one. But I did. I bought some of the capacitive pens, and that's what I used to just draw and doodle on. But it is. I have another guy at work that I work with who's a designer, and he uses it for taking notes and writing things down and transferring it. So those are actually pretty cool. They're just not as like sensitive as maybe as I'd like. But again, you know, in 5 years, I'll be completely different.
Nice. Okay, our next story, just a quick mention about the Node Beginner book. For anybody interested in getting started with Node.js, Brandon's favorite toy at the moment, right?
Yes, I love Node. That's a different story.
This is a nice HTML free book for beginners to get started with Node.js. Don't have to go out and buy a book. Get started tonight on it and start going through this projects, basically, is how they've structured it. So that, you know, your basic Hello World project. Then you go through some use cases so you can start to grasp, well, when would you use Node.js? They talk about the application stack that you need to launch it with, setting up the basic HTTP server, you know, analyzing that, event-driven callbacks,
yep,
all the way up to, you know, handling post requests, handling file uploads, and then the conclusion for it. So it seems like a pretty good book, and it's completely free, and you should go out and read it.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with a free Node book. So for me personally, I love Node, but what I find is that it is a huge departure from what we're used to, since things are asynchronous, that we're constantly doing callbacks and you're constantly doing the callback structure makes it seem a little bit spaghetti-like. But nonetheless, yeah, if you haven't played around with Node, it's fast as balls. I mean, it's killer. It really is a great language, and I think that this opens up a whole new language for developer or designers who have gotten kind of comfortable with JavaScript to now really be able to start take some of the power of server-side processing and do some amazing stuff with it.
Awesome. Yeah, one thing that I liked about this book is the guy said that he's not a JavaScript expert. He said there are some people that are really great at JavaScript. He's not one of them. So you can feel assured that this is written by somebody who is not an expert. You know,
yeah.
Oh, that's good. Above your head. Yeah. So he says he's, you know,
this guy's a jackass with JavaScript. So let's read his book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he says it's like going from novice to advanced, but you know, he's not going to just jump right into the deep end. So I kind of like that about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What do we have next, Brandon?
Oh, God, you're going to call me on it now. Now I'm going to have to flip through here and pretend like I was completely prepared. Okay, here we go. So let's talk about, you know, the one that I actually want to talk about is so I've been pretty hard up on Mongo lately. And the one problem that I've had with Mongo is the lack of kind of, you know, there's on the Mac, there's, I think it's called Mongo Hub, and it's an application, but to be able to use it on your desktop, you got to open up a lot of security things, which I didn't care for. But anyway, we all, if you've ever done anything with PHP MyAdmin, it's a web-based administrator for MySQL. Well, this guy came up with PHP MoAdmin, and it allows you to manage kind of all of your collections and your tables or your databases and all that with Mongo. And Mongo is a great database that I'm just totally in love with right now, and that's all I've been playing with. But PHP MoAdmin makes it really easy for you to see everything that's happening in your database. It's unfortunately ugly as sin. The guy has got like four themes, and they're all just ugly as hell. I mean, it's like there's no there. It is a very ugly application, but it's a free download that you can just you download, you install it. You almost have to do no configuration, no setup, and boom, there you go. You can now kind of see all of the things that are happening within your Mongo database. You can set indexes, you can set, create new tables, create new databases if you need to, because, you know, with Mongo, you don't really need to do it. It'll automatically do it for you. But it's a great application, highly recommended. I use it, you know, all the time. You can go and you can edit documents, you can do all that. It has a lot of room for improvement, but nonetheless, it's a free one that's out there, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and if there are any designers who want to help this guy out, I'm looking at a screenshot of it right now, and it desperately needs
it. It's nasty. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, I feel dirty every time I use it. But programmatically,
I might have to send the guy an email.
Yeah, he needs help. But I'm sure the tool is very useful.
And then, so Mongo, again, check it out. And now if I get a pick out of one of the two, because I know we're coming up on our time frame here,
yes.
Let's think. I'm going to pick Podio. Podio. Podio is basically what Salesforce would do if they were a young startup. And so if you're like in a business or you're thinking of starting a business, Podio, PODIO.com.
How about we call it Podio?
Podio. I like Podio. Podio. Okay, fine. Podio.
Like children's program.
Podio. 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 it's free for up to 10 users, and it allows you to have basically all like your intranet, your CRM. They have a ton of apps that are available for it, that you just go, you create your accounts, and I think what their whole angle is going to be is just creating an app store for it. So, but what's cool about it is the interface is beautiful. The interface is very well designed. You know, when people are creating the applications for it, they all kind of can flow consistently, kind of like what Salesforce does, but without it being so ugly. It's a great application. I signed up for it today. I was playing around with it. They've got like that Twitter stream, kind of like what's the corporate Twitter account that kind of got
Yammer,
big?
Like Yammer.
Yammer, yeah, exactly. So it's got that Yammer kind of functionality. But when you're ready to upgrade, it's only $4 a month per user. So even with a company with 30 people, it's still a little bit manageable. It's a very promising looking platform as far as I'm concerned. I don't know what their plans are for making like an SDK available so people can develop their own. But I know like, okay, I want to go and I want to add an accounting package to my iPod IO installation, and there's FreshBooks. You know, a lot of people are starting to build integrations for it, but it's a very cool platform. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, there was a Hacker News article a little while ago with a guy who was a diehard Basecamp user for years, big 37 Signals fan, and it was basically a Dear John letter to Basecamp saying he had to break up with it and he was going to Pod IO. And he listed out all these great reasons of why Pod.io is really whooping Basecamp's butt right now.
So. And it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, they really try to take that angle of, okay, we're going to build the platform, and as long as we can make it easy for people to build applications for it, and it flows within our kind of overall user experience, it's a great application. I highly recommend people check out of it. Yeah, check it out.
Looks awesome. I'm going to be checking it out very soon.
I think we have a design article. Is that right, Steve? We're actually going to get a little bit of design talk in here.
Yes, finally. Thanks, guys.
Damn designers.
I'm only kidding. This one caught my eye. White space. Why is it important? And it's actually written by a guy called Mark Bolton, who's local. He's from Manchester. And it talks about the negative space in between, everything. I mean, if you look at typography, what makes typography good and legible? Well, it's the negative space in between each letter. So those design principles come to mind when you're designing a website. How important white space is. For example, you know, you look at, again, look at Apple's advertisements, how, you know, you've just got this one bit of text and an image and there's all this space around. And you go on Twitter, it's got, you know, beautiful spacing on there and things like that. And it's just a really good article to kind of find out why it is important, because I've done work in the past that I've had a design that's had really good white space in there, and I've been told to remove it completely because they want, you know, because things need to get above the fold here and there and everywhere. Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of not, the white space is so important. It's, you know, like I said, it is what allows us to read our language. Like I said, negative space in between letters and things like that. What's your take on that?
I think that especially for new designers, this is a hard technique to grasp, is handling white space well, because you don't think about it. You don't focus on it. You're laying out all of the elements that you do see, and you're not focusing on, oh, well, you know, if I space this out a little bit or I get rid of this piece, it actually improves the overall user experience. You know, it will make it less cluttered. Clean interfaces are definitely in right now. Mastering white space is a skill that every great designer needs to have right now. So I agree, this is very important.
For me personally, if you don't understand the power of white space, then you're not a designer. I mean, hell, I'll go back to 1993 when I was in journalism and I was in charge of the design of the newspaper. And the whole purpose of it, or of my role, was, you know, my teacher consistently just beat me over the head about what we called it then is the negative space. And if you don't know it and you don't understand what it is, then you need to stop doing design. designs for people, and you need to spend a couple weeks, you know, really researching it and understand how important that it really is. You know, I mean, the lack of the empty space is more important than the space that you fill. So I agree completely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's like when you look at a design, and when you're using, when you're putting a lot of white space in there in your designs, you know, it really does need to come natural to you. I mean, I come across designs where people don't have enough line spacing, which again is down to, you know, they need white space in between the lines and things like that, which makes an article monotonous to read. And like you said, when you worked on with regards to journalism and things like that and design. You know, it's the same principles there as well. Obviously, you know, you need to make your articles more legible. You need to make the text stand out. So, you know, white space, it is important.
If you don't understand white space, you are not a designer. It's that simple.
The voice of God has spoken.
Yes. Remember it and live it.
I like it. Well, that is a good note to end on. Thank you, guys. That's all for this week. And as always, go check out townoply.com. Post links to interesting articles that you find, and maybe we'll mention them on next week's podcast. So thank you, guys.
Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.